You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. That was my little allergy sniffle there.
Yes, and I have those too.
And this is Writer's Voices, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, mom. On this beautiful day in Fairfield, Iowa. It is fantastic.
We had a really heavy frost overnight.
Yeah, this is Indian summer now, guys. After the first heavy frost is Indian summer. And that means warm days.
And cool nights.
Yeah.
And cool nights, yeah. So we have a really interesting show for you today. Mm-hmm. We've got two authors, so we've got half an hour for each. And our first author, I believe, has been with us before, and this is her new book. Mom, you want to tell us a little bit about whom we're going to speak
with? Yeah, we're going to be talking to Janet Thompson, and her book is Dear God, Why Can't I Have a Baby, which affects many, many women in our country. And she is the founder of Woman to Woman Mentoring, and about this, and about his work ministries. This print is so small. I think I need new glasses. Sharing life experiences and God's faithfulness is a promise of Janet's books and the things that she speaks about. And she's the author of Face to Face Bible study series, praying for your prodigal daughter. Dear God, say they can't. They can't. They say it's cancer. And Woman to Woman Mentoring Resources. She is widely read, I'm sure, because all of these titles are most interesting in our culture today and most needed.
Janet, welcome back to Writer's Voices.
Thank you both for inviting me back.
So, tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this new book, Dear God, Why Can't I Have a Baby?
You know, I've had a history, it seems, in our family that of infertility, but also just in my work with mentoring, I'm always aware of the issues that women are dealing with or struggling with, and just having a difficulty finding support, sometimes even in the church. And this is a very controversial subject, I discovered. But I had two daughters, a stepdaughter and then my daughter, who both struggled with infertility, and you know, it's not just a couple's issue, it becomes a family issue. Mm-hmm. The whole family goes through this with them, and as I saw my girls struggling, and I myself, at an early age, was told that I would never have children, and I really know that devastating news that you just can't believe, something you just thought you were entitled to your whole life,
yeah,
maybe not going to be available to you. I really felt a need for a book that covered these very sensitive, delicate issues from a Christian and biblical perspective.
Well, it's very hard for women to, when all of their friends are either pregnant or have newborns or have children, you know, toddlers and so forth. And of course,
right,
once you have that, that's what your life is. And that's what you're
And you go to church, and there's the families,
yeah,
and the Sunday school. And, of course, whenever there's something that you want, it seems like everybody around you has it, and, you know, you don't.
Yeah.
And even, you know, just last night I received an email from a young woman who, you know, just was sharing with me all the things people are saying and, you know, how desperate. I mean, it is a form of desperation, just as Rachel said, you know, give me a baby or I'll die, Rachel in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Many women get to that point. But, you know, Monica and Carolyn, when my books usually have something of a personal story running through, as well as I invite other women or couples, whatever the topic is, parents, to share their stories too, because everyone's story is so different, and I want the reader to be able to identify not just with us, but with, there's that commonality that we all experience in infertility, but some individual kinds of issues. And I was amazed when I put the call out for stories, I was inundated. Women and couples were really anxious to tell their story. They oftentimes don't have a place to tell it. And
right,
this seemed like a safe place that not only could they tell their story, but hopefully help another couple going through a similar struggle.
Now, Janet, you talk about your daughter and your stepdaughter who feature very prominently in this book. In fact, there's excerpts from their journals in here.
Right.
Was it difficult to write such a kind of an intimate portrait of your own family to share with the world? Did you have any reservations or hesitations about that?
You know, actually I did it because it's kind of a known fact in our family. If something happens in our family, beware, mom's going to write about it. My okay. family pretty much all shares my point of view that mentoring is simply sharing those, been there, done that experiences, and with God's help, I made it through, and you're going to make it through too, and I'm going to be there walking beside you. That's why the subtitle is A Companion Guide, and God's going to be there with you. And so oftentimes, you know, we want to be really closed about the experiences in our life, but as Christians, God lets us, I think, have some of these experiences so we can reach out and help someone else going through that struggle. Mm-hmm. And if we don't talk about it, we can't do that. And so all of my books actually have something, the Praying for Your Prodigal Daughter, Hope, Help, and Encouragement for Hurting Parents. That prodigal daughter, Kim, is the Kim that's in this book, later struggled with infertility. And this Dear God, Why Can't I Have a Baby is the second in a series. The first one was Dear God, They Say It's Cancer, A Companion Guide for Women on the Breast Cancer Journey. And in that book, I shared my own breast cancer journey. And I invited the girls, would you be willing? And in that book, in the cancer book, I shared my journal, ran through it, and then 45 other women shared their story. In this book, I really, each of my girls, their struggles were different, their solutions were different, the way they handled it was different. And I asked them, you know, would you be willing to share this? And their response was, if what we've gone through and the hurt we've experienced can help another couple or another woman going through this, they were anxious, actually, to tell it.
Good for
really
them.
Really proud of them.
Yeah. Yeah, good for them. Not everybody will. Not everybody's able to do that, you know.
They're not. But as I mentioned, I was amazed at how many were, you know, had a story ready to be told. And men, I have, you know, daddies to be, wrote their side of the story of what was going on and their feelings also.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular area, while it is so personal, I think there's just such a need for support. And it's very difficult for these couples to find that kind of support. Sometimes even in the church, it's a very close topic. When I was writing the book, I was a longtime member of Saddleback Church, and they actually have an empty arms support group. They have a grief support group.
Oh,
and I'm finding that that's not always common.
No,
so
it's
oftentimes
not.
The couples might go to some really good organizations. One of those is Resolve, which is an excellent support group. But it's not particularly Christian-focused and Christian-based. And that was what I was really hoping to provide for them.
And actually, you know, in a small community, you don't have access to some of those organizations either, you know.
Right.
So those are the people that really, really need. And sometimes they have had to go to a doctor many, many miles away and procedures.
You know, I now have moved, and I'm in that situation. I live in the mountains of Idaho now.
Oh, yeah.
It's an hour and a half away, so
yeah.
I totally identify with that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so they feel totally removed from help and isolated, I'm sure.
And
yeah, go ahead. That's our friendly neighborhood train outside the window.
Yeah.
No, I was wondering, is that an announcement of some kind?
Yeah. I don't think
it's actually Amtrak. Amtrak is going past.
I thought maybe it was a signal we were taking a break or something.
No.
Anyway, Janet, you mentioned that this can be a controversial subject, particularly in the church. Do you want to address that at all?
Well, one of the things I was starting to say before our train break there was it is so difficult when, for example, in our book, the two girls were both experiencing infertility together, and there was that camaraderie of their situations were completely different, but they had that, you know, we're not alone feeling together.
Yeah.
And then when Shannon, my stepdaughter, became pregnant before my daughter Kim, she writes in the book of just the desperation and the isolation that she felt, even within her own family, because she felt pretty much abandoned. And I think, even though that wasn't reasonable, in fact, it was, you know, it's in the chapter on, you know, spinning out of control, she knew that it wasn't a reasonable reaction. but it was that natural reaction. And I think that that can happen so much in the church. And I really want to thank both of you so much for allowing me to talk about this book. And because I'm even finding on even Christian radio stations, it seems to be kind of a taboo topic, and yet one in six couples struggle with this.
Wow.
I think I know why, because...
The church sometimes doesn't know how to reach out, and I think that, you know, there needs to be some education in there, too. But
well, see, they
know that one in every six couples sitting in your church, it may be secretly...
Yeah,
struggling.
That's it right there.
The church and desire and desperation to have a baby.
I think the church ministers or whatever consider it a private matter, and this is why they don't address it. I really believe that's what's going on.
Right.
They think it's,
and yet it has become so public with it being so prevalent. I mean, in any other situation, if one in six people were experiencing something, that's like an epidemic.
That's right.
So, it's not something that, you know, and for years, I can understand, you know, for many, many years, it was very difficult to talk about breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had to use that word breast. And
And
now, you know, because of more publicity and more awareness about the devastation and the prevalence of that, it is a topic that many churches will have a support group for those women or, you know, somewhere where they can guide them and lead them and mentor them.
I think, you know, of course, part of the reason it's controversial is because some people, there's what would you say? Well, there's controversy about the solutions that couples
use. And one of the things that
this.
I love that I was able to do in the book was to really make aware of how, on the other side of the coin, the Christian community is really coming to not only the aid of these couples, but to humanize what's going, you know, what can be happening as part of infertility. For example, there's an organization called Snowflakes, and a number of the couples in the book shared their story. And that's a Christian-based adoption agency, part of Bethany Adoption Agency, that the foundation of it is actually in Fullerton, California, which is back where I used to live in that area. And they have, it's a very legal program where couples can actually adopt frozen embryos so that all these little lives in waiting that are in freezers, these couples who are desperately wanting a baby can actually go through that adoption process and give those little frozen embryos life. And that, those are, I mean, they sent me a book of some of the first 100 babies that were born this way. And also one of Kim, they adopted this precious little Hispanic baby boy that, you know, can't imagine our life without him. And there's so many children that are so in need of home. So, you know, those are the things that church talks, I mean, and the Bible talks so much about, you know, taking care of the orphans.
Mm-hmm.
And we just need to open up and, you know, get these people together,
right,
couples together with the babies and the children that are so needing a good home.
Right. Now, Janet, you mentioned that one in six couples struggle with infertility.
Yeah.
Is that an increase from the past? Did you do any research about that?
Yes, I did. And, you know, that's this hard thing to tell, too, because not only is it closed now, it was even more closed in the past. And I actually do talk about, you know, you would see a couple without, in my own family, I remember, it wasn't really an aunt and uncle, but we called them that. And they had dogs, you know, because they could never have children.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really ever talked about that. Or maybe there'll be a couple that will just have one, because also secondary infertility is very prevalent today. And it just, you know, wasn't something that anybody questioned people about. Is this, did you not want to have kids, or did you
didn't ask them.
In fact, my husband actually was born in Iowa, and his mother suffered, both of her first baby and her third baby both died 7 and 11 days after birth, and she herself was adopted. And that was something my husband never even knew until I took a genealogy class in seminary. It was just so close. Everyone was just so closed about it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
It's kind of hard.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to get the statistics from the past.
It is.
Oh,
it is. But I would say if you look back at, I mean, our our ancestors who had 10 and 12 kids, and as the years progressed, you know, families were having less and less children, and so I think it's a little bit of a both.
Well, I think if you look at those families with 10 or 12 kids, you will find one or two of those kids who did not have children, you know?
Yes.
Could be.
So it may...
Generations go down, exactly.
Yeah. And, like, did you ever know, like, Mom, your Aunt Helen, who didn't have children, do you know if that was why she didn't have children?
Well,
did it
was...
come up?
No, yeah, it was an infertility thing.
It was,
yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then another aunt, see, there were nine in my mother's... my mother and her siblings, there were nine children, and another one of her sisters had one child, and that was all she could have. And my mother happened to know this because, you know, she was close with those two women. But I know there are people in my past that had no children, and no one ever questioned. I don't remember anyone ever questioning them why. It was just assumed that they didn't want children, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And not everybody does, so.
And yet, and also I think, too, that there is now more opportunity for solutions than...
Right, right.
...what to do back then, except there wasn't many things that they really could do about it. But, of course, right now I'm actually, and you mentioned the Face-to-Face Bible Study series, and I'm editing the next two that will be out, which will make seven in that series, and those will be out next January. And the study is Sarah, Rachel, and Hannah pleading with God. And, of course, the Old Testament especially has many instances, and especially those three we're aware of,
who were barrenness and
crying and pleading for a baby goes back to the beginning of time, practically.
Absolutely.
And it was something, obviously, the Bible was open and talking about.
Yeah, of course, you know, back in the day, it was you were deemed to be unworthy if you didn't have a child. You know, it was a different culture thing.
Right, even grounds for your husband to divorce you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Janet Thompson, author of Dear God, Why Can't I Have a Baby? A Companion Guide for Couples on the Infertility Journey. So, Janet, how long did you work on this project?
Oh, wow. I started it because I had a passion for it, and I, as soon as Dear God, they say it's cancer, was out and published, I was writing the next in the Dear God series. I began writing this book, and it was just definite that it was going to be the next book, actually, even by that publisher. And then that publisher went through some changes. And anybody in the writing or publishing industry can tell you a story like this where, maybe they weren't going to do it. And I couldn't believe, I was just devastated. Like, I just knew God had, I had all these stories. I just knew this was a book that really needed to be available. And so I did, that was kind of the turning point for me to get an agent.
Mm.
We're talking a little bit about Writer's Voices, and so that
right.
was my main goal. I had, up to that point, published without an agent.
And what difference has that made for you?
Well, in the beginning, one of the things I said was, well, he helped me get more no's than I could have ever gotten on my own.
Was it hard to find an agent?
I had more doors shut than I could have opened, probably. And this was the book, you know, this was the one that I really, really wanted. Well, in the meantime, I began to write some other books, the face-to-face studies started going, but this one was always on my heart, and it had been half-written, and he knew that. And so we kind of let it go set by, aside for a couple years, and then the door just opened up that someone from that first publisher that was going to write it was now working at Leafwood and remembered it.
Ah.
And isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
And actually contacted my agent, and, I mean, they just wanted it like now. I mean, I
Whoa.
Had
been
in the middle
yesterday.
Of writing three other
yesterday.
Books, and I wasn't going to say, no, I can't get this one out on time. So, fortunately, I had written about half of it and just went to work on the rest. So I that's why I feel so strongly God's going to use it mightily.
I was going to say, well, that's the way God works, that person uh-huh. remembered, you know.
Just being patient.
Yeah.
Just, you know, not getting frustrated. And
Right.
Now, Janet, you say you put a call out for stories for people to share. How did you do that?
I do that in all my books pretty much, and I just start the networking going. When I know that a book idea is coming along, even long before I'm ready to sit down and write, I will put it on Facebook, Twitter. I'm on ASA, Advanced Writers and Speakers Loop, sending out emails. Anybody who, you know, just casually emails me, I go, by the way. And in this particular instance, somebody always knows somebody that is struggling with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with breast cancer, was the same way. So if I say, oh, I'm writing a book on infertility, they'll say, oh, my cousin needs that. My next-door neighbor needs that. And I'll say, well, do you think that they'd be willing to share their story? I just ask.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll ask them. Or people will say, yeah, I would like to share it. So I just, pretty much everywhere, anybody I'm talking to, because as an author, people ask you, what are you working on now?
Right.
And so you
right.
tell them, and then they say, oh, okay, I have a story.
For example, the next one in this series, the Dear God series, is Dear God, He's Home. And that's going to be a book for couples where the husband is now home from retirement, laid off, disability. For whatever reason, he's now home full time. And immediately, someone will go, I need that book, or I'm about ready to get it, have that book, or I know somebody that has a great story for that. And it's just amazing. As long as you're open about it, the stories just come, and that way I get a variety of stories from all different sources.
You know, another faction of that might be he's home from the military.
Yes, that's another. That is one. Yes,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is going to be that part of that illness, disability, and military. Yes,
right.
Or even working at home. That's interesting too.
Yeah.
Some of the office, you know, many are becoming those virtual offices, and that's a transition also.
Interesting. Sure. Well, Janet, would you share a section from the book with our listeners today?
I would love to. And I, based on the email I just got last night and our discussion, I would kind of like to share, there's a section called Dealing with People's Reactions. And, you know, my daughters both share about just the strangest reactions that people have. And so I have included the top 15 things not to say or do, and to say or do to someone experiencing infertility. And I thought it might help your listeners also just to kind of know what that is. When I was writing Dear God, They Say It's Cancer, I have a similar list, and people would beg me, like, what are you going to put on that list?
Yeah.
Because we so don't want to say the wrong thing in
no.
any uncomfortable situation, and yet so often we do without even knowing it.
No, you don't. You don't realize what you're, no.
Yes.
You're trying to be helpful, supportive, but it doesn't come out right.
And in fact, at the top of the list, I have a quote. She said, I believe in the front of every church directory, there should be a list of things that you shouldn't say to people during times of grief, just like emergency preparedness in the front of the phone book.
Uh-huh.
So, and she was a woman struggling with infertility. So the verse I chose to be on top of this list is Proverbs 12:25, the New Living Translation. Worry worries a person down, an encouraging word cheers a person up. So one of the don'ts is don't talk about people you know with infertility. Good or bad stories aren't helpful. Do let me talk about my story and listen. The second one, don't tell me God is in control, has a plan, or knew it was going to happen. Do show me God's love. Don't say I'll pray for you unless you mean it or tell me to pray harder. Do pray for and with me. Don't say, call me if you need anything. Do something for me.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pity or patronize me. Do show compassion. Don't avoid me. It makes me feel rejected, different. Do keep normal contact with me. Don't take your cue from me as to how comfortable I am talking about it. Do act like don't act like nothing is happening, or minimize my situation, or compare me with someone else. That's the don't. Do take your cue from me as to how comfortable I am talking about it. Don't tell others unless you have asked permission. Do honor my privacy. Don't offer unsolicited advice or suggestions. Do support my choices. Don't be resentful of how my infertility affects you. Do remember this is about me. Don't forget about me after the initial flurry of the diagnosis. This could be a long haul. I need you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let me grieve. Do let me grieve, and that takes time. Stick with me. Don't say you understand how I feel. If you haven't experienced infertility, you don't understand.
Right.
Do listen without trying to fix it or make comments. Don't ask me personal questions or give advice or suggestions. Do curtail curiosity. Don't assume it's a female problem. Understand this is personal. And then number 15, I left for them to fill in. And then on the other side of this page, there's suggested responses, and then I just kind of put some humor in when for some
these
of the
are
things
good.
That people say. Some of the, gave them some responses that they could give without offending the person, but at the same time kind of changing the topic if they're uncomfortable.
I want to ask you something about you think that adoption is becoming easier now, more accessible to people? I've heard in the past people say that adoption is so difficult. The process is so difficult.
I'm sorry, I could barely hear you, Carolyn.
I'm sorry.
A question about adoption.
Yeah, I was wondering if adoption is becoming more accessible now, perhaps.
Yes, I would say definitely. There are many books out now about New Hope has one out with my publisher, Face to Face Bible Studies. And I believe that, you know, many churches now are, especially with a lot of churches that are doing missionary programs in other countries, but there are so many children in our own country that are so needing adopted.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a misconception that, oh, it's just so expensive. You know, my kids were not wealthy at all. My daughter had wanted to stay home, and so she had even quit working and trying to have a child. And I mean, there's all sorts of you do get a tax deduction that makes it you can take a loan out and where you don't have to pay it back for a while. There's just, you know, many, many ways to work around. I think that's been a stigma that it's just so difficult and so expensive.
Yes, I think it is
back
too.
In the book, I do have some suggested agencies that are Christian based.
Oh, good.
To work with.
Well, Janet, we're about out of time. And I want to thank you so much for coming back on Writers' Voices. And your book is available, I'm assuming, at any local independent bookstore or Amazon?
Yes. And christianbook.com.
Christianbook.com.
And any probably online bookstore, Barnes & Noble.
Great.com
or at their bookstores. Right. And also, I would just let your listeners know that I do a newsletter that I'd be happy to put them on the mailing list for if they want to learn more about my other books. My website is woman, that's W-O-M-A-N, singular, womanmentoring.com. So it's womantowomanmentoring.com.
Great. Thank you so much. And let us know when your next book is out.
Really? I'd love
yes,
to let
please
you know
do.
That.
All right.
I love talking to you, and I really appreciate you having me back.
All right, and now we're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to get our next guest on the phone.
Bye-bye. Have a good weekend.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, and this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're back for our second half of the show today, and our second guest, and Caroline, she came over this morning, and she's like, wow, I am just so excited about this book.
This is really good.
This is
Hope for Families of Children with Cancer. Linda T. Young and Chaplain Jonathan Ward are the authors, co-authors. This book is a must for anyone who is facing this terrible thing. It just is.
And Linda is with us today. She's the co-founder of Kindred Spirits International, whose ministries include children's hospitals and a refugee women's mission in Kenya. She's a writer, national speaker, and has done much volunteer work. And her husband has done cancer research for 40 years, Dr. John L. Young. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Linda.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your having me on.
Well, as I said, this book is a must because it's very readable, and there's not a lot of technical things in it. You know, it's personal. It gets right down to the nitty gritty, and that's what people need when they're going through this. How did you come to write this book?
Well, we had moved to Atlanta about 13 years ago. Excuse me, from California, and when we got here, my husband was working at Emory. And I knew that there was a children's hospital on campus that had a schoolroom. And I'm a retired teacher, and I thought, that would be a good place to volunteer. So I went down for the training and started working there, volunteering in the schoolroom. And then one day, in 2002, it's the first chapter of my book, which I may read in just a few minutes, but just God opened a door. He really did. And I was in the schoolroom, and one of the teachers asked me to do a bedside tutoring for a child that was there for a bone marrow transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up to the room and met this family, and it just changed my life. It really did.
And you saw at that moment then how you could help.
Yes. People in those situations are there 24/7.
Right.
And especially they're in isolation. They can't leave very often. Families can't come in because their immune system mm-hmm. is so shaky at that point. You have to be so careful with germs. And so you were just totally cut off from the world. And you're going through this horrendous thing with your child, and they are so sick, and you don't know what the outcome is going to be. And that is, you know, part of the cancer journey. And then there is a regular floor, and those people come and go, but it's still the same journey that you feel so alone and overwhelmed and really have no place to turn, many of them. And I just thought that a book that they could hold in their hands and take with them to home, back to the hospital, back and forth, just something as a quick read from stories of people who've been there before them, and that they would understand their feelings and could connect with them.
Well, this is not a large book. It's not a thick book. It will fit in a purse. And that's part of the beauty of it.
25 pages, yes.
Yeah.
It would fit into a purse.
Yeah.
Yes. It started out as a hardback when I started writing it. I self-published at the beginning with Kindred Press. I became a small publisher. And then over the years, then we went into softcover, and then Leafwood Publishing picked it up last year. And so they have now come out with the book, and they've just changed the cover, and but the inside of the book is the same. And so it is still a very manageable size, and that you can just take with you as you go and read as you have a few moments to do so.
Yeah, I want to clarify it. It almost sounded like you said 25 pages, but it really is 225?
255.
Yeah, I'm thinking, is this the same book we're talking about here?
If I would be a very small book.
Well, you know, there's I particularly liked the part where you talk about the personalities, the different colors of personalities. I thought that was so interesting.
Well, thank you. I have been teaching personalities, per se, and communication for 35 years, and I call it uniquely made, Y-O-U, uniquely made, and it is just such basic information, but it is so needed when you're going through a crisis situation, and how we all deal with crises in different ways. Of course, first of all, we have the male-female part, but mainly the more outgoing people, they see the glass half full,
mm-hmm.
and
They want to talk to people. They want hugs. And usually you're married to the opposite of somebody who wants to Google it to death and withdraw, but get all the information they can. And so we look at each other and think, why aren't you reacting as I'm reacting?
Uh-huh.
You know, this is our child. And just to have a little bit more information along those lines of personalities, how we deal with stress, what fills our empty emotional tanks, just takes us so far, because the stress on that journey is horrendous. And families tend to pull apart even more. And as they pull apart, you know, the communication gets less and less, and you end up with a lot of divorces. And also, even with the communication with your children, the others, the siblings who feel left out, how to reach them, how to communicate.
Right.
Even to understand your friends and the professionals in the hospital, they're humans first and professionals second. And so to understand why they do what they do really, really does help.
To understand why some of them have to be detached.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a fine line to walk.
Yes.
When you're a professional, a medical professional, and you go into one of these situations, you want the family to know that you're caring about them, but you can't go down the tube with them.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, some, are very type A type of personalities, and they'll come in and they will give you the information and then they leave, and families are sitting there saying, they don't care about my child. Well, of course they care about your child, but you feel like they don't because they haven't given you the time or the maybe the hugs or the affirmation that you need. So you have to realize they have personalities too,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's important.
Well, bedside manner counts, but not as much as competency in treatment.
True. Yeah, but you know it. Yeah. But I know what you're saying. You don't get a vibe from them like, oh, okay, this is really important to them too.
Yes, right. Yeah. And to put yourself into their shoes, how would you like to have that job that you're doing this, you know, some of them 6 days a week,
yeah.
and you're on call, and you're dealing with all of the parents and these very sick children and other staff members, and of course you want the best for these children. But that is very draining. And probably at home, you've got your own family to deal with, your
mm-hmm.
own health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so to kind of step back and see them through through their eyes of what they're dealing with, too, helps you appreciate where they're coming from.
Right. Well, you give so many practical things, like what a list of things that you should take, you should have at the hospital with you, because you're going to need these things. And you don't realize that, you know, right away, but this book gives you an idea of what you're going to face here. And how
I appreciate your saying that, too, because with childhood cancer, it's never expected, because we think of cancer as being an older person's disease, which
mm-hmm.
it is. But when it hits a child, it just knocks you for a loop. And you don't think about, okay, what am I going to take to the hospital to make my hospital room home? And the things that you're just going to need. Also, you're taking in all of this information, all of this new terminology.
Yeah.
And just trying to get your mind around it. And so if you have, and we listed things in the book, such as an extra journal and a notebook to keep numbers in, and don't just depend on your iPhone or whatever. You need it in black and white to give to somebody else, too.
Yeah.
And things like slippers for your feet. It's cold at night.
Mm-hmm.
Extra bottles of water. Just things to try to make your child as comfortable as possible, but also you as comfortable as possible.
You know, you have to write things down that they're doing to their child, too, because when my husband was in the hospital the last time, I had a list of every time that he had had a procedure, and sometimes those things don't get in the records, but I had them listed. And this one doctor said, oh, I gave her this sheet, and she said, oh, here's the mother load. then, you know, and
that
I was,
so
I was,
wise.
Yeah, I was proud of myself that I had done that.
I will remember. No, you won't. No, you won't. Your mind is so crowded with
yeah.
so many things.
Yeah.
And unless you've got it written down, you're probably not going to remember it. Also, there's a chapter in there on steroids and
mm-hmm.
chemo and things like that. And if you can kind of keep a running log as to, like you said, what they have given and then the reaction to it.
Right.
And then you can look back and go over that and suggest even things. Okay, if you will give them this medication before you give them this steroid or this chemo, then they won't throw up as much, and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be your child's advocate. And
oh, absolutely.
It's a full-time job, absolutely. But to keep things written down, keep them in one place so that you always have it with you is just so, so very helpful.
And you need to be not afraid to ask questions.
Yes.
You know, because I used
exactly.
to think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes we don't want to be that squeaky wheel, think.
Yeah.
We don't want to, you know, impose on their time, et cetera. But your child is the most important
mm-hmm.
of anything that's going on.
That's right.
And you ask the questions, but you ask them nicely.
Yes.
And if you start, you know, having an attitude, and they're not taking care of my child like I think they should, that is so counterproductive. So, yes, to ask the questions, to probably write them down before you see the doctor. Don't try to catch him in the hall as he's going to somebody else's room.
Right.
Make an appointment to see him or to, when he's coming into your room, to have those things ready,
mm-hmm.
But to respect their time, and especially the nurses. They are the frontline people that will be with your children, and they've seen it all before, and
That's
they
right.
will see it again.
Yeah.
And they are a wealth of information. Child life specialist, same way.
Mm-hmm.
And they can give you so many good, helpful hints of what to say, when to tell your child, how much to tell them what's going on, what to tell the siblings and your family, and that type of thing.
You know, telling your explaining to your child what's going on is probably the most difficult thing that you have to do.
It is. It is. If your child is older, they're going to know something's going on.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you don't use the word cancer or you don't tell them specifically, it's floating around, and they're going to be a wealth of misinformation if they don't hear the truth from you.
Mm-hmm.
And child life specialists and people like that in the hospital are wonderful at giving you suggestions of how to tell a child this. If they're younger, many people think, well, my child is young. They won't understand. I don't want to scare them. But you can tell them a certain amount on their level, and they need to know they can trust you with the truth, that you have told them the truth. And it's not like everything's going to be fine and hunky-dory, you know, because it may not be.
Yeah.
But we're in this together. We're on a team together with the doctors. They have wonderful medicines. All of that is truth, and that gives them encouragement.
Well, you said not wanting to scare them, but it is a scary thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's a stage before that of coming to grips with it yourself.
Uh-huh.
And that's like working through the stages of grief. That first we want to play like it really hasn't happened.
Yeah,
and
right.
Somehow the tests they have done
are wrong. Somebody made a mistake.
Usually.
Yeah.
And then when you come to grips with it yourself, and then you get the information, forewarned is forearmed,
mm-hmm.
and you have that down, then you're going to know better how to approach your child and the rest of the family with the plan that you and the professionals have come up with.
Right. Right, because there is you do have a plan. You have a plan of attack. They have a plan of attack, of course, to try to treat this, you also have a plan of attack on how to respond to it.
Excuse me.
You also have a plan of attack on how to respond to these things that they have to do. How you tell your child what's going to happen, because it is it's a scary thing. The hospital itself is scary. Let's face it.
And it is, but I'll have to say, over the years, the children's hospitals that I have been in, which I have visited several across the country, they really work so hard at making it a child-friendly environment. Mm-hmm. You walk in, and you know, there's multicolored stuff, and there's, you know, things painted on the walls, and everything is headed towards the child and child-friendly. Even with the teenagers, sometimes they have a separate we have a playroom for the younger children. But for the teenagers, it's a hangout room. And they try to make it as comfortable as possible. And even the rooms themselves, you have like a bed sofa for the mom or whoever to spend the night. And so it's not a place you choose to be, but if you have to be someplace, it is totally different than it used to be with four white walls. And so we've really come a long way with children's hospitals.
Good.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Linda Young, author of Hope for Families of Children with Cancer. And Linda, would you like to read to us?
I would be glad to. I'm going to read you my first chapter, and this is where it all started. And the chapter's title is God's Coincidence. Childhood cancer is not a journey anyone chooses. Not children, not parents, not family, not friends, not anyone. I haven't walked this path, but I've been privileged to walk with those who have, as I volunteered at a children's hospital schoolroom in Atlanta. Volunteering has taken care of my retired teacher need. It's those moments when things clicked and a child got it. Even more important, I've been blessed with God's coincidences. Those moments when things clicked and I got it. That's what happened one morning in the schoolroom. One of the teachers said, Linda, there's a 7-year-old girl in room 356 that needs bedside tutoring. She's in isolation, in for a bone marrow transplant. Do you have time to go? I did have time, so I stepped into the elevator and prayed my usual quick prayer, please use me, Lord. Third floor chimed. Doors slid open, and I headed down the hall. I stopped at the closed isolation doors and hit the entry button. My shoes clicked down the short hall, four rooms on each side, carts stacked with disposable masks, gowns, and gloves leaned against the wall. I turned to the metal hand-washing sink and stepped on the floor pedal. The cool water mingled with soap and sloshed over my hands. How long did they say to do this? 20 seconds? I grabbed the paper towels, tossed them into the trash, and turned to 356. Each time I stood outside these rooms, I was apprehensive. I always wondered if I could be of any help in these extremely difficult situations. I knocked gently on the door. A muffled voice said, come in. I pushed the door open slowly. Hi, I'm Linda Young from the schoolroom, here to help Danielle. The mom waved me in from across the room as she finished brushing her teeth at the sink. I'm Hetty. Sorry, I have to get this done when I can. I walked over to Danielle, propped up in bed, her black hair pulled back in a red kerchief. Purple and blue paints, paper, scissors, and pipe cleaners filled her tray table. What a cool butterfly picture, I said. She smiled wanly. Do you feel like doing any schoolwork? I just want to paint. I glanced around the room at photos of two beaming little sisters, floating butterfly-shaped balloons tied to the IV pole, and art projects tacked to the wall, making the room home 24/7. On Hetty's chair, her well-worn Bible laid open. Hetty leaned over her single bed sofa and folded the sheets. Here, sit down. I sat down and shifted pillows against the wall for comfort. She shoved her books to the side and sat at the other end of the bed. She told me Danielle's cancer had returned after a 4-year remission, and they fit the protocol in Atlanta, so they moved from Miami, Florida. Danielle was scheduled for a bone marrow transplant from one of her sisters. My husband's new job fell through when we arrived, she told me. Unfortunately, her story continued downhill from there, including losing the down payment on their house and their car being wrecked.
Oh, no.
I have to laugh not to cry. The storage unit has charged 4 times the amount they had quoted, so they're holding our furniture hostage. All we have is the suitcases we brought from Florida. She told all of that without bitterness, just with exhaustion and a faint smile. I know God is in control, but we're so weary. Danielle's eyes slowly closed as the IV pain medications took effect. She pushed the tray to the side of the bed and snuggled against her pillows. I'm going to be praying for Danielle and for you and your family, I whispered. Thank you so much. How can I pray for you? For me? Well, as a matter of fact, our son and his family are going through a rough time. They've just moved from Missouri to Wisconsin, and when they got there, the house they were going to rent was a shambles. So the 6 of them have been living in a motel room for weeks. They do need prayer. I know it isn't anything compared with your situation, but it's tough for them. A few minutes later, I left the room. I had no idea how this woman and child would affect my life. Since 2002, we've shared Hetty's reoccurring struggles, deep valleys, and God's provisions. God's coincidence? I got it.
Yep. That's what it was, for sure. You know, I was interested, talking about the things that you can do to help with the release the toxins in your body, like the deep breath exercises.
Yes.
And that, you know, that deep breath exercise, that's a vagus nerve, isn't it? Or vagus nerve. There's a nerve that runs clear down your body, and if you activate that with a deep breathing, it relaxes all the organs in your body.
Do you know? I did not know that.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, it does. Yeah.
I just know it's important.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's what does it. And
water, exercise, all of those things release the toxins and get the endorphins going, which makes you feel better.
Yeah, right. And you need
thank you for sharing with me about that other. I will put that in another book.
Okay.
I asked Caroline how she knew that, and it came from her vocal training.
Yeah, when I, you know, because when you sing, you have to breathe from your diaphragm. You don't breathe through raise your shoulders. You breathe out from your diaphragm, and that's what activates that. So
Linda, we only have a few minutes left, and I noticed that Hope for Families of Children with Cancer is part of a series. You Are Not Alone. Is this the book, first book in the series?
Yes, it was. Yes, and like I said, I had self-published it in 2002 as a hardback and then a softback later, and then Leafwood Publishing has picked it up and has picked up the series, and so it is out through them now, and that came out this year. The second book I did was Hope for Families of Children with Congenital Heart Defects, and then the last one I just now finished was Hope for Families of Children on the Autistic Spectrum.
Oh.
And that has just come out last week, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
It is all in the You Are Not Alone book series. That's correct.
Well, if they're all as good as this one, and I am assuming they are, then there are many people who are going to benefit from your writing. And that's that's really great. It really is.
And Linda, how did you make the connection with Leafwood Publishers?
Well, I have an agent that I had gotten through my book marketer. I have met somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And so my agent, I had told him that, you know, I was looking for a publisher and other than myself, and he had gotten me in contact with Leafwood and set that up, yes.
Well, I'm interested, you know, you self-published first. Why did you decide to go with a commercial publisher instead of continuing the self-publishing
route? Well, self-publishing can be very expensive, too, and it depends on how you do it. I had hired people to do my editing after I'd finished the book, and then someone to do the formatting and to get it to a publisher, I mean, to a printer. And so all of that together can really add up. And so I felt like if I was going to continue to write these books, I really needed to, you know, have it through a book publisher. And most publishers have said, you know, it's a nice idea, but we do not, but it's too small of a niche, or we do not go to, we don't market to children's hospital gift shops and to organizations and things like that. Well, it is in, you know, regular bookstores too. But so this time I just felt like it was time to go with another publisher. Yes.
Great.
I also like the way that you have the little inserts, and of course that's my thing is
the
sayings,
quotes, yeah.
The quotes, yeah.
Yes.
And but they're very nice. They really are, because they keep focused on the real thing here. This is a, you know, God is in charge, but
yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes, 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 yes. And that's basically who the hope is in, because we can say we have hope, and yes, we do. We hope our children will get well and that they will live productive lives, et cetera, et cetera. But bottom line, we really can't promise anybody anything.
No.
We can come alongside, we can love them, we can pray for them, and we can be there. But as far as giving them, you know, specifics, this is happening, this will happen, this, we really don't know.
Right.
And bottom line, it's who our hope is in, and it is in Him.
Linda, that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for being with us on Writer's Voices, and we always close with a quote.
This quote is from your book.
This is from your book.
Yeah, it's actually from Corrie Ten Boom, who was a Holocaust survivor. When a train goes through a tunnel and it gets dark, you don't throw away the ticket and jump off. You sit still and trust the engineer.
Amen.
Amen. And that's it for Writer's Voices today. If you're listening to us on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. He has some fantastic interviews coming up. Joe Fassler, who's a writer for The Atlantic and a professor at the University of Iowa, and who's performing Saturday night here in Fairfield at 8 p.m. at Revelations. And Chandrika Tandon performing at the Sondheim on Sunday. And this is also on Planet Erstwhile, J.P. Sotillo with Inside the Headlines at 4 p.m. and filmmaker Ali Salim talking about his film Sweet Land. What a show. See you next week.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.